From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When the news of widespread NSA surveillance broke after documents seized by whistleblower Edward Snowden were made public, Americans were stunned by the extent to which the U.S. government was spying on all of us. The stories broke one after another, making the careers of people like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, exiling Snowden to Russia, and even spawning an Academy Award-winning documentary. Now the story of whistleblowers, drone warfare, and mass surveillance is told in stunning comic form in the new book called Verax, which means truth-teller. In Verax, which was one of Snowden's aliases, co-authors Pratap Chatterjee and Khalil Bendib take us on a powerful journey with a wide-ranging cast of characters to expose these crucial issues of our time. Pratap Chatterjee is an award-winning journalist, author of Halliburton's Army and Iraq, Inc., also executive director of CorpWatch. He's written for The New Republic, The Financial Times, and The Guardian. And Khalil Bendib is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller Zahra's Paradise, which has been published in 16 different languages and nominated for 2 Eisner Awards. His political cartoons are distributed to 1,700 publications worldwide. And the two of them are co-authors of the new book, Verax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. Welcome to the program, Pratap and Khalil.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. I have to say, I truly do enjoy reading histories like this in comic form, because it can turn something that's relatively dry into something much more interesting. And I want to start with asking the two of you about the first few pages of the book, which have very little text in them. All you see is somewhere in Central Asia, and it's just images of a drone flying over a Central Asian neighborhood somewhere with a group of kids playing. Why did you choose to start the book this way? Pratap first and now Khalil.
Sure, we want to give people a sense of what drones look like and how, you know, they spy on people. And so it was really just sort of a taste of what's to come, because the book is actually quite heavy with conversation and with journalistic detail. And we felt we wanted to ease people into this topic by showing them what it actually felt like. And so you'll see more than just the images of a village somewhere in Central Asia, but this sense of something buzzing around, and it's sort of omnipresent existence. So that's the taste we want to give people, because people who live under drones see them all day, often all night, and they hear them. And given that it's not just an eye in the sky, which is bad enough, you know, somebody watching you, imagine that in, you know, relatively conservative societies where women, for example, are veiled, etc. Now you have men watching you from above. But more important than all, you know that they might attack you and they might kill you, whether you're guilty or not. These bombs could fall anywhere.
Right. And so drones have that dual purpose of both surveillance and warfare outside the United States, where the U.S. deploys them.
Exactly. And even more than just surveillance, it's this sense of terror that it generates, because people feel like there's an Amnesty report with that's titled "Will I Be Next?" And that's the sense we wanted to start to convey to people: is that when you live under a drone, a name of another important report on the subject, you live with the constant fear not only of being watched, but of dying.
So when you number the actual victim,
mm-hmm.
Yes. So when you number the actual victims of drone strikes, the official number, according to investigations by people like Pratap, is about 6,000. But actually, those are people who were killed. The people who suffer from the drone's presence, a constant 24/7 threat, that's in tens of hundreds of times more numerous. And a lot of people actually lose their minds just being exposed to such a terrible technology.
And Khalil Bendib, you are the brilliant artist who has brought this story to life. Let's talk a little bit about what your background is and how you prepared to do this kind of art, from a village in Central Asia to a control room in the US military to scenes of Prothap interacting with Laura Poitras and Julian Assange, etc. What was the preparation that you did for putting this book together visually?
Well, for the prologue, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, those six pages, we debated for a while, Prothap and I, with the help of our editor, about the wording, the dialogue. And then it occurred to us at some point it would be a lot more powerful to just drop the words and let the images speak for themselves. So that's what happened. It's more poetic that way, more visual, more striking. As far as preparation, I had been, after Zahra's Paradise in 2011, after its success and its distribution worldwide, I was ready to do another one. And I was thinking of doing something on whistleblowers. I was at first focused on Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning. It didn't quite happen. And in the meantime, the revelations by Edward Snowden really made it quite exciting to use him as the focus of this drone, this whistleblowing that meant not just lack of privacy, lack of democracy in this country, certainly, since we're being subjected illegally to monitoring by the authorities. But also, and this is where Prothap's special contribution came in. I mean, Prothap had been following this beat of mass data for years, and I knew that. So that's why I approached him to do this together. But Prothap was also interested in the drone, in the drone warfare, because it's the same basic technology, surveilling people here or abroad, that allows the US military and the CIA to attack people with the drones.
Right.
So we made that link, and we decided to show how this is more problematic than people expect. It's not just the lack of democracy, which is in itself a huge problem. But it's also attacking innocent people abroad for sometimes the wrong reasons, and also blowbacks. I mean, if people don't care about people dying, innocent people dying abroad, how about the worry about the blowback, creating more people who will be really motivated to attack this country.
Now, Prothap, as Khalil was saying, your journalism is sort of the vehicle through which the story is told. And I think that's a really great way of also looking at this history, because while this is a story of whistleblowers and of the actual issue of mass surveillance, the documents that were released, it's also a story of journalism and how sort of dogged investigative journalists have worked countless hours to expose the stories in a field that, you know, has fewer and fewer jobs. You even sort of showcase some of your struggles with the confines of modern day journalism. So how important was it? Was it simply that it's a more engaging story to tell, done through your eyes, through the eyes of an individual person exploring this very complex world?
Well, actually, I was opposed to having myself in the book. And I thought that the characters would speak much better for themselves, like Edward Snowden or
Glenn Greenwald
and people like that. But both Khalil and the editor convinced me, it took them maybe a year or 2 years for them to convince me that I needed to be in the book.
Did you have to ask Khalil to make you really flattering, or did you argue about how you were portrayed visually?
No, but I was opposed to it. I didn't want to do it. And it was nothing. I just thought that, you know, I'm just a reporter. What's the point of showing me and my difficult journey? What's more important is these whistleblowers. And it wasn't, there was no sort of false sense of modesty or shyness. Yeah, I thought really the story to be told was the story of people, you know, who risked their lives and who risked their careers. Now, what Khalil and the editor pointed out was that it is actually very difficult to tell these stories without being able to bring them together. So mass surveillance, people see this as Edward Snowden's story, the invasion of our privacy. And then they see drones as a story about something in Pakistan, Yemen. They don't connect the two, right? And in fact, they're very much connected. The reason the NSA spies on people is to, quote unquote, track down terrorists and kill them. And you can't separate
the stated reason.
Stated reason. but that is also how they get them. They do track them with cameras, with computers, and things like that. So you can't separate the two. And in order to explain how drones work, you have to get beyond the fact that there's just a robotic plane in the sky. It is the work of hundreds of people, gigabytes, terabytes of data that are all brought together. Now, unfortunately, nobody's told that story. So the way to tell that story was to use my work in combining these two to tell everybody else. I mean, let's say I was telling the story of, I don't know, some person from history and I was not involved. I might not be as important, but in this particular case, it was actually crucial that we show the overlap between the two because I was the one trying to put these together.
And ultimately, VRAX, as you explained, meaning truth teller, it was about not only the whistleblowers, but also about the brave journalists who go out on a limb, regardless of resistance from the mainstream, like Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Pratap Chatterjee. A lot of people who just do the right thing and just go out there and dig up the truth, regardless of consequences sometimes.
And we've been in the room through Laura Poitras's videos. She's, you know, one of the documentary filmmakers who was a journalist involved. Her film Citizen Four, and, you know, she seems to go nowhere without her camera. But I'm sure there were moments where she didn't have her camera. And of course, Pratap Chatterjee was interacting with people without the camera. How did you, Khalil, portray these scenes? Did you and Pratap talk about what he remembers them looking like, who was in the room, and how you sort of recreated, which is the beauty of comic book format, you can recreate visually something that wasn't captured in video?
Yes, it was my job to, as you said, recreate these scenes. Some of them I had the help of photographs, sometimes video footage, but mostly it was getting the information from Pratap, who not only about his own work, and we follow him throughout the book, but also he interfaced with these people, the Julian Assanges of this world. He knew them and he remembered how they, you know, it's portrayed in the book, how we met with them and how they collaborated to find out and expose the truth on a lot of these subjects. So it was my job to kind of try to, as seamlessly as possible, put this into some kind of narrative form so it would be easier for readers to follow it.
So some of this book more like a traditional video documentary than you'd guess, because there is video footage available online. So you can sometimes find these locations without going there. Many places, I went back and took photographs. So I went and photographed with the help of the editors of The Guardian precisely where Laura and Glenn met with Janine Gibson to discuss Snowden. Of course, I worked at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. I returned then, took photographs there. So when I was in Pakistan, I actually filmed a lot of it. So Khalil was actually able to see the places because I had either already photographed them, I went back and photographed them, or we took advantage of, neither of us went to the Mira in Hong Kong, but we relied on Laura Poitras' Citizen Four and footage from the internet. And we paid a lot of attention to detail, just as you might in a documentary. So for example, there's a scene where you see a plane taking off to go from Hong Kong to Moscow. We researched and we found video of that particular flight, maybe not Snowden's flight, taking off. So we actually replicated exactly what Snowden would have seen when he looked from the plane.
Wow.
So now this isn't true in all cases. There are some instances where we had to, in fact, rely on Khalil's amazing imagination. And in fact, I think in some of those scenes, it's very exciting because, of course, he had some opportunity to be more creative. So, for example, we had a transcript from the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, on of drone operators talking about people that they were about to kill. And we don't have video footage of that. So then,
Khalil, in Afghanistan, right?
In Afghanistan. Gun, yeah.
So you have to sort of dramatize that and bring it to life.
Yeah, so I didn't really have to invent that much. It's really still very much a non-fictional effort throughout. I had photos of people very much like these two pilots that we were portraying in the book. The only thing I didn't have were the exact two faces, and I had to imagine two faces. But the transcript of what they were saying and what they were worried about, is this a child I'm seeing? Is it not a child? They end up shooting and killing people. That transcript is an absolute, it's a transcript I think we got from
the ACLU.
From the ACLU.
And even the planes that you see, the Kiowa helicopters, etc., these are the actual planes that we used. So there was, of course, there are other parts which hopefully you will see if you read the book, when people read the book, but where we've been very creative in depicting the security system as, or the drone system as an elephant and as the Pentagon.
There's use of metaphor, but never an invention of a different airplane or a different machine that actually wasn't existent. It's really very true to life. But from time to time, I had to come up with some images, and sometimes Shortap would come up with some as well, trying to make something more visual, more accessible, more easier and more fun to read. So that was the real balance we tried to strike between journalistic accuracy and a little bit of imagination, just to make the whole thing more fun, frankly, to read.
Right. These are issues that if you start simply just reading what it is the NSA is capable of, how they've gone about doing it, what this technology is, your eyes can glaze over. So the story of how it's unfolded is a really great way to educate people on what exactly has been happening. And Pratap, let's get to some of these really crucial issues. I think the fact that you've linked the technology of drone warfare and the technology of mass surveillance is crucial, because traditionally people have treated them separately. What is the takeaway that you want people to get from this link? Because here in the US, while we might fear NSA surveillance, we don't as yet fear drones in the sky for anything other than, you know, the use, you know, uses that photographers might make of them.
So, you know, it's interesting. Somebody, with one of the talks we give, somebody said, how far away are we from drones being used in the United States to kill people? And it's interesting. I think the answer is tonight. They could be used today.
Right. The technology exists.
The technology exists.
We've already killed U.S. citizens.
We've already killed, exactly, Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. These drones are piloted from here. There are a lot of drones here. The capabilities are here. So I don't want to be alarmist or any such thing, but if, for example, the police in Oakland were hunting somebody and they felt they needed to kill them and they had no way to approach them, it would be entirely possible for them to bring in a drone and kill them. There is no reason why they wouldn't. So this is not something that is that distant or far away at all. Drones have been used to surveil people in the United States, not very often. The technologies that are carried above drones are used every day by police forces throughout the United States to track people. So there's something called a stingray that we depict there. And it's also known, the more technical name is an IMSI catcher. It has the ability to follow your phone around. Well, that technology is used by the police in Oakland. It is made by a company in Florida called Harris. So most of the technologies that are being used, whether it is drones, which are used on the U.S. border, predator drones are used every day in this country. They may not be armed. but they can be armed. They are built with pods in which you can just slot literally a weapon and fire it. So, you know, an hour from now, if they wanted to shoot somebody in the U.S. border, they could. The technology they use to follow people around is already being used. So we are minutes away from this.
And Khalil, I wanted to ask you, the fact that these are issues that directly impact the lives of foreigners. I mean, we know we're being surveilled, but we can't tell unless we're really, you know, watching the watchers that we're being surveilled. But in other countries like Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan, et cetera, where drones are deployed and have been for years, their impact is felt in a very real way. And I feel like that has allowed Americans to push this issue out of view. So you, of course, depict the victims of drone surveillance and strikes in the book. Was that an attempt to humanize the very faraway victims of our wars and our surveillance?
Well, there's always that, but it's a very objective way to depict what's actually happening, whether it's happening, unfortunately, a bad coincidence, it's happening in mostly Muslim countries, and we know how Muslims have been demonized and continue, and is getting worse under Trump. The fact that it's mostly these Yemeni kids and women and children, Pakistanis, Afghanis, it only makes the problem worse. It's called supposedly a war on terror, but it's actually, unfortunately, making things worse. It's creating more problems in terms of our safety here in the United States. I was especially touched myself by these little sweet faces I was depicting in the book. The 8-year-old girl, a 5-year-old kid, a 16-year-old teenager who shocked Pratap by, you know, he met him in Islamabad, in this big conference, he was sitting with him and joking about soccer, and they had a good time. And 3 days later, the same kid, Tariq Aziz, was killed by a drone strike by the CIA. So it does humanize these people who, unfortunately, are swept under the rug as far as our media are concerned. And it's not a healthy thing.
And Pratap, in terms of the surveillance specifically, all of the information that came out from Edward Snowden's revelations was told in the documentary Citizen Four, and that you detail in your book. What impact has the journalism about those issues had on actual policy? We've had lawmakers over the years since the revelations came out in 2013 make all sorts of noise about the unconstitutionality of it. But having written this book, having followed the story now for so many years, what can you tell us about the ongoing surveillance? I'm assuming, from the NSA's perspective, very little has changed, even though we know what they're up to.
Well, there have been changes. First of all, policymakers have been able to enact a certain amount of changes, which has made it harder for agencies to just collect everybody's data without their knowing. They do need more robust sort of warrants to be able to get the data. So there has been change in policy. Of course, that is within the United States. This is not really about people around the world. And so the privacy of Americans is somewhat more protected because of the changes on Capitol Hill.
Well, that's a relief.
Well, only to a certain extent. I will say that actually the biggest changes come not from Capitol Hill, but from industry itself. Because they have sped up and been forced to use end-to-end encryption. So Google, for example, is by no means a saint, and they collect a lot of our data and they abuse it all the time. But certainly their search engine system, places like WhatsApp and Facebook have realized that they need to offer uses at least the appearance of privacy. Now, there's still a problem there, because if Facebook turns over your data to the police or to the NSA or the CIA, there's nothing much you can do about it. But they're certainly not leaving it wide open. So there is a lot of changes happened in industry to make browsing more private. But as we have discovered, particularly through WikiLeaks recently, they've been developing newer weapons and newer ways to be able to get hold of not just the data from the data centers, such as from Verizon or AT&T, but by hacking directly into your device and taking control of the device. So whether even if you're drafting an email, they are able to use what's called keylogging software to figure out everything that you are thinking as you type it. So in some ways, we're better off because our communications are better protected. In other ways, so long as the companies continue to collaborate with the government, which they do, we may be in exactly the same place. It's actually very hard to really tell, but they've certainly given us the software industry has tried to give us more assurance. Now, there was actually a very interesting story in the New York Times this Sunday by Scott Shane and a couple of other journalists showing that in fact the NSA's tools have now been stolen by a group called the Shadow Brokers. In fact, all these tools they're using, so this is the more terrifying part of it, is not just that these tools exist and that the government is spying on us, they're now available for sale by the Shadow Brokers to the highest bidder, and they will be used against everybody by these people for ransom and for any other possibilities, which, you know, when what the mind boggles, includes, and we refer to this at the end of the book, the ability to be able to go in and blow up power plants and nuclear devices and things like that. The intrusive
technology. So that same sort of stealth technology that allows you to take over a device can be weaponized?
It can be. It's a complicated phenomenon, but it is possible. In fact, it is the way the U.S. attacked nuclear facilities in Iran was by taking advantage of flaws in everyday software, including things like Microsoft Word. It may seem like a fantasy or some such thing, but this is actually real. The ability to be able to attack your computer and take control of it rests in the fact that there are flaws and holes in the security systems we have. And so all you need to do is take control of, let's say, the software that controls a power plant. And this is, everybody uses the same kind of software from Siemens and people like that. If you know a way into it, you can seize control of it and you can use it to shut things down. So this, the suggestion in the new article by Scott Shane is that in fact the NSA's systems and WikiLeaks has actually started publishing some of this. They've sort of de-weaponized it, but they've shown the scale of the system is now out and available to everybody. So it's a very dangerous Pandora's box that they have opened.
And by the way, on our website, there's a place where people can, now that we've thoroughly scared everybody, there's a spot on our website, Virax comic, and the singular viraxcomic.net, where we give a few tips on how to protect yourself, how to protect your software and all.
From nuclear war. No, I'm just kidding.
But
at least from spying.
So much of the story centers, the history that you tell in your book, Virax, the graphic novel style book, is told through the whistleblowers who risked so much, risked their personal safety, risked their livelihoods, in order to follow their conscience and tell the story. Khalil, can you tell me how you drew them, how you portrayed them as, you know, these really heroes, but who are just ordinary people?
Well, I was always inspired by them. Part of the reasons that we, in the alternative media, always are up against censorship and always are up against these same questions. Do I sell out in order to make a better living? Or do I stick to my guns? So these guys were always heroes of mine. They go much farther. I mean, their lives, their families are exposed. it's truly remarkable. That was the impetus for the book for me, and that's why I approached ProTap. At first, I was really focused on Snowden and the guys around him, Poitras, Greenwald, etc. But then after a while, it occurred to me it was also about these other people who are also pushing in the same direction, trying to dig up the truth, no matter what, no matter what might happen to them. So it was fun for me to follow these people and draw them and portray them as I've done in the book. And it's a little bit, you know, setting an example, showing these guys just the way that Snowden himself wanted to do, which is at some point they ask him, what's going to happen to you? He says, well, whatever happens to me, there'll be seven others. If they do something to me, there'll be seven others stepping up to the plate because they'll be inspired by my example. So that was the whole inspiration for the book for me.
Pratap, I wanted to just wrap up our conversation asking you about the end of the book, near the end of the book, since we've been talking a little bit about, you know, this technology that has been exposed. You have a section in your chapter 17, which I thought was fascinating, but a little bit wonkish. You do a great job of explaining it, you and Khalil. It's the vectorization of the human. What is this, and how does the fact that technology is being used to reduce human beings to stick figures, essentially, what impact does that have on, and what, how does that lead to deadly mistakes?
So in order to be able to track people on the ground, on the other side of the world, with unfamiliar names, speaking languages that soldiers don't know, in a different time zone, you need to be able to identify them, and you need to be able to differentiate them from other people. So what the military does is that they try to look for characteristics. And so in the book, I interview a mathematician at the University of York in England, who says that essentially what the military has done in doing this kind of remote control warfare is to reduce everybody to a mathematical system. And it's this seems odd, but when you think about big data, what we're doing with big data is we are trying to find information out of huge quantities of often disparate kinds of information. So video information from the drone, phone call information, emails, bank records, etc. So you've got to be able to connect the two together. So the system, just as the people at the NSA and the CIA and the Pentagon, is essentially using a mathematical formula to decide who, and algorithms, which are sort of equations and methods of sorting through data to figure out who is a terrorist and who's not. And so we try to explain how that works. And we also try to explain how that data, in fact, and how that data analysis is really based on probability and assumptions, and in fact can often lead to mistakes. So when the military says we hit somebody, you know, and we know that this is a terrorist, they're actually not telling the full truth, because in fact the technology can only calculate approximately where you are, despite the fact that we have phones that tell us where we are via Google Maps. Google Maps doesn't know where we are, because in fact the reason we're able to see where we are is we are looking at satellites. So satellites can't all look at 10 million people in a big city like Karachi or New York. So we try to explain why, and I want to give a plug for a new report that I published called Drone Inc., which explains the mathematics and the technology and the engineering behind it, and why the military is doomed to always killing innocent people. And it's partly because they rely on this technology, but technology can never bring justice.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. Khalil, give out that website again where people can find out more about the book.
It's Virax Comic. .net.
We'll post that to our website later today. Thank you both so much for joining us. My guests have been Pratap Chatterjee, award-winning journalist, author of Halliburton's Army and Iraq, Inc., and Khalil Bendib, the co-author of the New York Times bestseller Zahra's Paradise, which has been published in 16 different languages and nominated for 2 Eisner Awards. Together, they've just written the graphic novel-style book called Verax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.